This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 116. I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, which is an extra 45 minutes, please join the Patreon campaign. And I've just added a new feature to Patreon where you can get a 7-day free trial, and that will give you access to more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. So this week I'm talking to three guests. I start off by talking to James Madden about his book, Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy and the End of the World. And in the second half, I'm talking to Darcy Weir and Andy Marcial about the documentary Transmedium Fast Movers and USOs. So to start off, I'm talking to James Madden. James is a professor of philosophy who writes about the philosophy of mind, philosophy of religion, the UFO phenomenon, and fitness. Hi, James. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy, and the End of the World. One of the things you say at the beginning of the book is you are a Johnny-come-lately to the UFO scene. So what happened? How did you get into the UFO scene?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just before we began the interview, I was thinking you would ask me that. And I was thinking I would use the phrase Johnny come lately. And I was worried whether that was a British term along with an American term. So apparently your audience is ready for that term. So very good. I always point out, you know, that for me, I was not interested in the UFO, especially from a scholarly or a seriously philosophical angle, until after 2017, when all the, you know, it started to break into the news again for the first time in a long time with the New York Times article and all that. You know, before that, you know, I was someone who, you know, certainly the popular culture, you know, visions of the UFO were things I found entertaining. You know, I'm a inveterate Gen Xer, a man of my generation. So, you know, I when I was in college and, you know, we watched the X-Files and all that. But it was never something I would deny. It was never something I took terribly seriously either. Okay. And then it was actually, and I mentioned this in the book, this summer, I believe 2021, I was watching X-Files with my teenage children. And while we were doing that was the first big Pentagon briefing here in the States happened. And it was amazing to me. So it seemed that suddenly this thing that I had always thought as, you know, fictional or at most something that someone would be, you know, you can't rule it out, was a topic being taken seriously by the Defense Department in some sense at that point. And that to me, you know, got me thinking, no, I need to actually maybe look into this. There might be something to this. So then, you know, I go into the, you know, into the podcast world and listen to lots of podcasts. I start reading books like Jacques Vallée, and, you know, various of his texts, and John Keel, you know, some of his texts. And then I discovered Diana Pasulka's American Cosmic, which in a lot of ways, I think as a professor of philosophy, that book really gave me permission in a way to take it seriously, because it was published by Oxford University Press. And Diana is a trained and credentialed, you know, professor in the humanities. And so at that point, you know, it became one of the main lines of research interest for me, right? Just in the last few years here.
And you say this book is mostly a cautionary tale. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, and as you've seen by reading the book, for me, the primary message of the UFO, and it could be literally a message that some other, you know, intelligent life, some other personage is trying to tell us, or it could be simply the lesson we have to learn from ourselves by the UFO, is indeed cautionary, it seems to me. It does seem to be cautioning us against something. And at least on the hypothesis that I'm averaging at this point, it's cautioning against our own humanistic fantasies, our own sense that humans are the measure of all things, okay, that the universe is here for the consumption of humans. And so it's in that sense that I see my book as a cautionary tale, because I see the UFO as a cautionary tale.
And it's in some way saying to the human race, they should have more humility and not place themselves at the center of everything.
Exactly. Yet another Copernican revolution.
There's a word you use in the book quite often, and it's ontological. So can you just tell us what that means?
Yeah, ontological is a common term of art used by philosophers and even beyond philosophy, but I'm certainly using it as a philosopher. By philosopher, I mean professors of philosophy. Okay. Ontology names one of the sub-disciplines within philosophy. Okay. So, you know, ethics, you know, studies conduct, right? The philosophy of mind will study the relationship between the mind and the body. And what ontology is looking at is literally the word means the science of being, the ology of ontos, right? The science of being. Okay. And it's an approach that we take in metaphysics, or it's a kind of question we ask in metaphysics about what are the ultimate categories of things, right? That be. Okay. So in ontology, we're asking, not like an ontologist would not be interested in, say, counting the number of objects in the room. Okay. The ontologist is interested in wondering what are the most basic kinds of things that are in the room with me. Okay. But yet spelled out in the broadest possible sense. So what are the most basic kinds of things that there are in the universe? Right. And so ultimately ontology becomes a theory of all there is, because it's asking what are the most basic divisions among things that there are that for us to find out about. And you can see, you know, for instance, in the UFO conversation, this phrase ontological shock is used quite a bit. You may have heard it. Okay. And it was introduced into the field by John Mack, the psychiatrist who worked with the experiencers. But before that, there was a phrase actually coined by a 20th century theologian, a radical theologian named Paul Tillich. And what is ontological shock? I mean, I take it, it's this discovery that what we thought were the basic categories of things, the basic categories of being, in fact, are incomplete. That there's another sort of category of being. There's another kind of thing that is here with us in the world that we had not expected. Or it might mean that ontological shock is to realize our ways of categorizing reality, our ways of, you know, grouping things, understanding things, you know, having an account of which things are and which things are fictional, turns out to be deeply wrong and deeply off base. Okay. And so I see, once again, to that theme of humility, what the UFO does is it invites us to redo ontology, to rethink the categories of being as we sort of presume them to be.
And you talk about the Goldilocks ontology. How does that fit in?
So, yeah, that takes us really to one of the central notions of the book, of the argument I'm trying to unfold in the book, okay? So we human beings, we tend to think of the world in categories that are most accessible to us practically, okay? So if I were to ask, this example I use in the text, if I were to ask my youngest son, Cormac, to go out in the backyard and tell me which things are there, what kinds of things in the backyard, he would probably report to me, you know, that there's a shed out there, okay? There's a tree in the backyard. You know, maybe there's some birds in the tree, there's grass growing on the ground. Maybe, you know, his older brother is mowing the lawn. So his brother's there and there's a lawnmower there. Okay. And he would give an inventory, you know, of the things that are there, but he would leave out, right? He would leave out, you know, that there's electrons back there, right? He would leave out that there's photons back there. He would probably leave out that there are microscopic organisms living in the dirt under the grass, right? He would leave out maybe the power company, you know, the electric company, even though there are power lines back there. And so the electric company is having effects back there. We would probably leave those out. You would probably leave out the block association or the neighborhood association. These things would not enter into his circumspection or his concern with the backyard. And why? Because humans tend to think of the world in categories of things that we can deal with, you know, visually, that we can deal with tactily, that we can handle with our hands, that are relevant to what we're practically doing. Okay. That's what I mean by the Goldilocks ontology. Is our common sense ontology is that group of things, that categorization of things that are just the right size. They're just in the right mean for us to deal with them. Okay. But the thing, the interesting point that I make with this, but the convenience to us, right, being in our Goldilocks zone of being, is not the measure of what there is. There could be many, many things that simply are not relevant to our practical getting around that are perfectly real, whether they be, you know, subatomic things, microscopic things, or massive macroscopic things, okay, whether they be organizations or the environment, such as these things, which might be just as real as, you know, the tree in the backyard, but we don't call them to notice because they're not relevant to our typical evolved ways of getting around.
So you're saying it's kind of like the UFOs, whatever they are, they're way outside of the Goldilocks ontology.
Exactly. Right. The school of philosophy of mind and cognitive science and phenomenology that I come through, that I think my way through, you know, would point out that the way we make sense of the world, the way we are able to cognize the world, is that we take a highly complex, a very diverse world, and we carve out from it what is relevant to us. Okay. That's not to say that the tree in the backyard that I notice isn't real without me. It's perfectly real. But the point is my evolved need as a human is what leads me to notice that tree rather than, say, all sorts of other entities that are in the backyard that don't come to human notice because they weren't relevant to our development as cognizers. And so it would seem, if this is right, and I think it is right, we leave more out of reality than we include in it, because otherwise we could have no grip on it. And so, yes, my hypothesis is it's not surprising that things like UFOs, things like ghosts, things, you know, like Sasquatch, whatever, these things that are anomalous or uncanny or make no sense to us, occasionally show up in our view of things. And they don't make sense to us, and they're distressing to us, and they're hard for us to deal with because our ordinary way of thinking just isn't set up to deal with everything there is. It's only set up to deal with things that are relevant to us. And there's many things in the universe one would expect that simply aren't relevant to us, at least under normal conditions.
And so with ontological shock, could it be that there's somebody who's so skeptical and his whole worldview is rooted in what he can find or she can find here, right in front of them, that to suddenly get proof that the UFOs are a thing, that really would be a shock. It's almost like overwhelming and they just can't handle it.
Right. Or just think, for any human being, we have our Goldilocks ontology. We have a sense of what is, okay? And this is what our practical lives are predicated on. And to see something from outside of that show up, that it would literally not make sense. And that would be distressing and frightening. And who knows what we would do to try to make sense of it in categories that don't belong to it. And I think this is to your point, Simon, the more heavily invested somebody is, like, you know, the more they have confidence in our Goldilocks ontology, the more resistant they might be to admitting there's something beyond it. And moreover, I would take it, the more shocked they'll be when something that doesn't fit shows up into our purview.
Yeah, I kind of imagine they might, you know, do that thing. They put their fingers in their ears and they start saying, I can't hear you. I can't hear you.
Right. Or there'll be a tendency to always try to make sense of what is beyond the Goldilocks zone in terms of what we already have in the Goldilocks zone. So I think there'll be a risk of always trying to normalize the phenomena, right? Always try to say, no, we can smoothly put it into these categories that we already have at hand. And that's often the right thing to do. Not everything is novel, okay? But I think we have to mistrust ourselves a little bit when we are so confident in our categories that we come to think that they are the measure of all there is. And I think, once again, that's the cautionary note that I think we need to take from the UFO.
And if you're normalizing it, that in a way is putting it in a box, and there's so much more to it. And it's almost like you're rejecting a whole lot of stuff that could be there and just saying, right, it's just metal spaceships, biological guys just like us doing science, when actually there's far more to it. And so normalizing it doesn't help.
Yeah, I agree. And think of that example you gave there. It's a great example, because what is that? You know, I know we're stereotyping it, but we could find instances of this. Is it's an interpretation of the phenomena as if it's a lot like us. You know, they're flying around in you know metal aircraft. They're scientists interested primarily in technology, interested in, you know, what have you. It's to say they're a lot like how we think of ourselves today, right? And I think this is something you can see in the work of UFOlogists like Jacques Vallée and John Keel, who look at, you know, the historical cases. And at other times in history, these seemingly same sort of phenomena were interpreted in the categories of the moment, which basically reflected the human self-conception at the time, the human sort of narcissistic presumption that anything out there that's smart would be a lot like us. So I don't find it terribly surprising that right after World War II, right after there's been a war fought with aircraft in the sky and, you know, was won through technological means, et cetera, that becomes the going interpretation of this phenomenon.
Yeah, because you talk about a little bit, I think, about Jungian collective unconscious. See, I'm getting out of depth already just saying those words. And how that may be in some way affecting the UFO phenomena. It's that the human race has a part of what the phenomena is in creating it. Is that right?
Right. This gets us into the hyper object. Let's say, you know, we get the notion of the Goldilocks ontology, the sort of just right size things for us to deal with. But we're going to admit there's more finely grained things than the Goldilocks ontology, the microorganisms, the microparticles and things like that, that we've discovered. But at the same time, and this is the work that's done by a contemporary philosopher by the name of Graham Harman, whom I cite in the book, you know, it seems that there's also things that aren't just smaller than the Goldilocks ontology, but are actually in a broad sense, much larger than the Goldilocks ontology. And Harman, you know, will give you examples of organizations like corporations, right? You know, a massive corporation, you know, his example is Pizza Hut, you know, the fast food chain here in the States. You know, there's no single individual really running that. Even the CEO and the board of directors are in a way run by the corporation. And all of them could be replaced and the corporation could remain. And all the people who work, you know, at the lower levels in the corporation, they don't really run the corporation nor do the shareholders. They're just as much influenced by the corporation than they influence it. And they could all be replaced over time. So Harman wants to make a case is that, look, a corporation is an object, in his view, no less than the tree in the backyard. It has a life of its own. It's doing something on its own. All right. And Harman will say, but then also, if you look at it, you know, not only the corporation, but, you know, the economy is a lot like that. You know, nobody really runs the economy. No one really even fully understands what's going on in the economy. But yet it seems to, you know, have a life of its own. It seems to be doing something. It's a reality that we have to recognize in order for us to get around the world in some sense. And another thinker, someone named Timothy Morton, you know, it makes the point that it seems that there could be objects, these grand systematic objects, what he calls hyper objects, that operate at levels of time and space, you know, temporal and spatial levels that just dwarf our ability to understand them from anything like a comprehensive whole or as a comprehensive whole, that all we are able to do is sort of encounter them at their very edges. An example that Morton uses is the environment. I mean, the environment's a real thing. There is such a thing as the environment, and it has a life of its own. And we can have effects on it, but we're not in complete control of it. We can never fully take the environment up and see it all at once or even model it all at once very well. But yet we can see the thunderstorms. We can see the snowstorms. We can, feel the inordinately warm day or the inordinately cold day, all the expressions in the environment as individual weather phenomena are available to us, but the environment as a whole is not directly available to us. We can only speculate about it. And we know probably we're getting more wrong about it than we're getting right about it. And that's what Morton means by a hyperobject. Okay. And if you think of it though, say something like the environment, extending the argument, Morton will point out global warming. He thinks, well, look, it's a process. It's something going on. It seems to be, have a being over its constituent parts because, everything is going to turn over, in its own life. But yet the global warming process of which everything's a part is going to remain up and running. So he'll say something like global warming, the environmental crisis is a kind of object. Okay. So note there, that's an object that transcends us. Okay, that we don't really understand. It's hyper with respect to us, but yet we played a role, according to the going theories, in bringing it about. Okay, so the idea here is hyper objects are these massive systematic beings that defy us in our ability to understand them and to deal with them because of their sheer temporal and spatial magnitudes. But yet we may have played a role in bringing them about. Like we may be contributing to the initial conditions that brought about those systems, even though now they've been loosed on the world, right? And they operate independently of us in a certain way. And so Morton, in his book, Hyperobjects, in their book, Hyperobjects, actually says a hyperobject like global warming or like the Anthropocene could even, after we've initiated a process that has contributed to bringing it about, it may make contact with us as if it were alien. Okay, I don't believe Morton has the UFO in mind there, but when I read that, I thought, oh my gosh, this could be a way of thinking about the UFO.
And so you talk about it being the UFO as a singular, not UFOs.
Yeah, I'm playing there, but yeah, it's the idea. Like, what if really? What the UFO is a grand systematic being, much like the environment, much like the economy, much like, to use Harman's example, the Civil War. And what we're seeing directly are more like the weather phenomena of the environment, okay, or particular events of the Civil War. And these are not really individual things in their own right, per se. They're expressions of a much deeper, broader phenomena. I wouldn't claim to be able to prove this. It's a speculation. It's a hypothesis, but I think it's a hypothesis that we could use to make a lot of sense of what goes on.
You say in the book that the UFO as a hyper object could be something that the human race initiated?
Or played a role in initiating. So think of something like global warming. If we think of that as a hyper object, certainly there were certain entities out in the environment, the atmosphere, carbon, all these things, they were there before us. But then we crossed certain thresholds in technological development, and our technology and those elements in the environment interact, and they interact in systematic ways. And they interact in systematic ways that are so powerful, so consistent, right? So enduring that we could now say, global warming is a hyperobject all on its own. And so it's not just our doing, it's a hybrid between our doing and something that was out there independently of us. Okay. So maybe the UFO is something like that. Maybe there were things out beyond the Goldilocks ontology that we we're aloof to or not privy to or just not concerned with in our normal human being. But now we have, through technological progress, through, you know, our this greater geographic expanse that we have on the planet, we've bumped into these things. And that contact has created systems and systematic beings, hyper objects, as it were, that are now up and running. And we are partial contributors to their being.
And so when we may have initiated it or contributed to it, would that have been like with the collective unconscious? It's because with global warming, we can see that it's because we're putting too much crap into the atmosphere.
Right.
But with UFOs, it's not like we could point at machinery and say, ah, that's what's caused the hyper object.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I consider in the book, and this is sort of playing on Jacques Vallée's control hypothesis, is, you know, Vallée points out that he thinks whatever the UFO is, and he's very, very careful about speculating about the inner essence or being of the UFO. I mean, he says, at least in Invisible College, that all he'll say is whatever it is, it's a control system, that it seems to operate by trying to create a sort of equilibrium through the use of mythology, the use of the introduction of ideas into the human thought world. Okay. And then Vallée is very careful not to go much further than to say, well, what's doing the control system? Okay. And something that I will point out is, you know, an organism is really a control system. I mean, if you looked at all of my parts, all of my cells, you know, all of my genetic matter, all of my organs and such, and you asked, okay, but which thing among those things is the organism? Well, no, the organism isn't a part among the parts of the organism. It's the systematic whole of the organism. Okay. And so what that leads me to think is, well, maybe the UFO is something like an organism of which we have been constituents for our entire, you know, history, along with many other things. And it's regulated us in the way an organism does through the introduction or you know, the introduction or the retraction of certain influences. In Vallée's case, this would be mythology or archetypes in a Jungian sense, right? And so it could be that this being a part of this organic whole has always been sort of the control system that has guided humanity, among other things, you know, through a process of evolution, what have you. And so in that case, it does then start to sound like it wouldn't be the collective unconscious, but you could make sense of a collective unconscious because of our participation in this organic hyperobject.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
I appreciate it, Simon. I would say this is one of the most insightful and interesting interviews I've been able to be party to. So I thank you. And I would love to come back and chat some more sometime.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot. The book's called Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy, and the End of the World. Man, I meant to ask you about the end of the world thing there. But people can get that on Amazon, can't they, and other places?
They can. Yes, definitely.
And do you have a website?
Yes, jdmadden.com.
Great. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, friend.
So moving on now to the documentary. And this was made by Darcy Weir with Andy Marcial. Darcy Weir is a young filmmaker and has been making a series of documentaries that focus on UFOs, the secret space program, underground bases, Area 51, Phil Schneider's Dulce New Mexico testimonials, and Bigfoot. Andy Marcial is an experienced researcher of over two decades, and he recently disclosed three Department of Homeland Security videos showing UFOs. Hi, Darcy and Andy. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Simon, thanks. Really happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So we're going to talk about the documentary, Transmedium Fast Movers and USOs. My first question is, what does it mean when you say transmedium?
Right. So this terminology has come up in the recent years. Basically, I pretty much became more aware of it after reading an article that was written by The Debrief, you know, a publication that focuses on a bunch of different things, but they started turning their eyes towards UAP or the UFO phenomenon. And they had done an expose on essentially testimony from people that there's a USO, unidentified submerged object phenomenon going on in our oceans. And they interviewed Mark D'Antonio, who I actually featured in the documentary. He discusses his experience on board a Navy submarine where a USO zoomed by. And they also did a Freedom of Information Act request and found communications between two higher level Navy personnel that were discussing essentially UAP that exhibited transmedium capabilities, meaning the ability to travel between our atmosphere and the liquid ocean unimpeded by typical physics. So, you know, if you've ever gone water skiing or you've jumped into the ocean, you feel the friction, right? You feel the resistance. And any craft that would enter the ocean would have more resistance than flying around in the air, which is a gaseous, you know, environment, very loose molecules, but you can't compress water. It's something that's uncompressible. So how are these objects able to travel at 600, 300 knots or something like that in our oceans unimpeded? That's what transmedium really means.
And with Fast Mover, then I suppose that's the nickname they give to them when they detect them?
Yeah, so it's been a longstanding kind of rumor within the Navy among personnel that whenever they're cataloging USOs, however they detect them, especially submariners, they are categorizing them as fast movers. And, you know, Mark D'Antonio mentions that. Jim Goodall, another researcher of our military's longstanding arsenal, whether it's in the oceans or in the skies, and many others seem to know of this secretive program. Even Tim Gallaudet, who is this former Navy admiral that I interviewed for the documentary, chief oceanographer for 7 years at the Navy. He was in service when the now famous Go Fast UFO video was caught by these fighter jet pilots. And he got to see that communication with the video on a private email chain within the Navy. And it was all about safety of flight. So they were basically saying, hey, if personnel are noticing these, maybe we should cancel our exercises because we could crash into them. That they seem to be everywhere in our flight exercise area out here. And soon after he saw that video, which was attached to the email, the next day it was wiped from his computer and all the other people on the thread. So I think that's what piqued his interest. And he started looking into the subject more after that. And from the people he's spoken to, and he's spoken to a litany of very credible people, wrote probably the Navy, the Air Force, and he even told me NASA, that said there's something to this phenomenon. It's very anomalous and, you know, it shouldn't be ignored.
Did you get the impression from talking to the guest you had on that the military, the personnel, they kind of used to it. This stuff shows up regularly, maybe not every day, but it's something that's not new to them.
Yeah, I did get that sort of perspective from multiple people I've spoken to over the years. I think that it is concerning to the American military, whether that's the Air Force or the Navy or the Space Force, just for the fact that they want to have command and control of whatever military theater they're operating in, whether that's on land, in the air, or in the ocean. And when they realize that something more sophisticated, possibly, you know, faster and more agile than them, is zooming around in those spaces, it's not something they are very happy about. Let's just say that.
Did you have any problems getting guests? Were there people that just refused to talk about it?
Oh, yeah. I've had problems trying to speak with certain people. I reached out to NASA over the past 3 years, trying to get a hold of Bill Nelson, because, you know, I was pretty shocked when Bill Nelson went public right around the time that he became the new NASA administrator, announcing to the public that he saw the UAP videos. He spoke to the pilots that were, you know, like Ryan Graves, Alex Dietrich, that had seen the UFO with their own eyes and, you know, chased them in their craft, David Fravor. And he was convinced there's something anomalous, you know, there's something going on here. And that this should be investigated. So, you know, that's NASA. And NASA for decades now has never shown interest publicly in the UAP UFO topic. So I reached out to the NASA PR team, actually through the help of Seth Shostak, believe it or not. I featured him in this documentary, Fast Walkers. Secret Space UFOs Fast Walkers. And when I was communicating with them, I was like, look, I'd just love to get something on the record from Bill or somebody at the NASA team that's, you know, now part of this UAP panel. And they are totally locked down. Like, their PR person just said, you can refer to our mission statement on the NASA website regarding UAP. That's it.
Yeah, and there's a whole ton of, I suppose, conspiracy theory stuff about NASA, isn't there, that they know what's going on and they got films of this and astronauts see stuff. But I don't know about all that kind of thing myself. I'm not really into conspiracy theories. But do you get the impression that they know more than they're saying?
Yeah, I do. I've documented that, too. I've gone into that over the course of like 5 different documentaries now regarding NASA and anomalies that have occurred throughout their missions in space. Yeah, astronauts have been on the record on those missions, recorded in what you would call basically a black box flight recorder. In those transcripts that are now declassified, you can hear, well, you can read them discussing strange things they've seen, either in cislunar space out in the middle of nowhere where there should be no satellites, or orbiting around the moon. They've seen things and heard things, which is strange. And then just orbiting around the Earth. I mean, back in the early days of NASA, before we even went to the moon, the initial missions were the X-15, which was the very first astronaut designation mission, because these pilots actually went to Apogee outside the atmosphere for the first time. And multiple pilots saw what you would call a UFO. and photographed them and commented to Life magazine, Joe White, Robert Walker, you can look them up. They were X-15 pilots. So was Buzz Aldrin. And Robert Walker did a presentation later on in his life where he showed one of these photos of a UFO outside the Earth's atmosphere on from an X-15 mission and said, you know, it was actually part of our task on our missions to look for things like this secretly designated by NASA.
Didn't they call them the moon pigeons when they went to the moon?
I've never heard them called that before. What's the reference to that, Andy?
If I'm not mistaken, I believe some of the astronauts from the original moon missions would refer to them as moon pigeons when they would see the white objects flying over the surface of the moon.
Interesting. I had not heard that, but I know that they saw lights and structures that shouldn't be there on the lunar surface. That's definitely recorded. And I think what I'm trying to get at, Simon, is like if the very first mission, the X-15, and then all the way through like the Gemini, that goes Mercury next, then Gemini missions, which they considered the bridge to the moon. If on those missions, they also talked about seeing things, and photographed and took video back then DAC motion picture footage of strange things. I think NASA's well aware that there's something out there that possibly has superiority flying around the planet.
And with the transmedium idea, we're seeing craft then that could be way out in orbit and in a vacuum, then come into the air and then go down into the water. Have you heard of that being seen?
Well, I mean, look at Kevin Day's remarks of what he witnessed during the USS Nimitz incident. So he said that they recorded with their instrumentation an object going from 80,000 feet. So that's basically space down to 20,000 feet and like into the ocean. There's a interesting gentleman, Chris Sharp, who apparently got testimony from somebody regarding more information on the Tic Tac incident. And he was stating that there was a full scientific report that insiders were presented that showed these Tic Tacs were emanating from a larger object that was ocean-based, that was in the ocean. So, yeah, it seems like they do go from space to our atmosphere, to our ocean, without a problem.
And so with these underwater objects, they go like really fast. But in comparison to, let's say, human technology, what's the fastest a submarine can go? And are there torpedoes that can be really fast?
That's right. So a torpedo we know can go, I think I show the M48, which is a special type of torpedo that creates super cavitation for the American Navy. This super cavitation is basically it blows like steam or something out the tip of it to create an envelope, like an air bubble. And that way it just shoots through the water ahead of it. And the Russian Navy is capable of doing that. Probably the Chinese at this point. Torpedoes can travel at, I think the fastest is about 170 knots. Or no, I'm trying to figure out. Probably like 100 knots, which is about 170 miles per hour. But, you know, with Mark D'Antonio's experience, when he was on board a submarine, and he witnessed a sonar technician announcing that a fast mover had moved by. This guy was alarmed at its speed going above 300 knots. So way faster than a torpedo that we know. A submarine can travel when it's cruising, when it's really got some momentum going, probably anywhere between 40 to 35, depending on which submarine.
With the fast movers then, if something's going past at 300 knots, I suppose it wasn't that close to the submarine, but at the same time, that fast, it's going to cause a lot of disturbance in the water. But do these things go by and there's just no disturbance?
I think that is what appears to happen. There isn't a tidal wave or something that forces the submarine to make evasive maneuvers or something. It's just kind of a detection from the sonar guys that they commonly see. And they're just asked to log it.
I suppose those USOs, they must have their own kind of super cavitation or something, mustn't they? Something that when they hit the water from the air, if they just don't decelerate, it's almost like they're not even traveling through the water.
It's really perplexing. I couldn't explain exactly what's happening, but there are experiencers, people that have reported UFOs over water, going into water, coming out of water. And the strange thing is that different accounts, different circumstances report that there's either water dripping from the UFO or sometimes no water. It just looks like the UFO came out and was completely untouched by the water, if that makes sense. It would seem maybe not super cavitation, but they just have some kind of field activated, or I don't know, that just something that allows them to not be affected by the water.
They can be sure they're not glitches in the equipment that's just throwing something up that's not actually there.
Yeah, I think that's basically what Jim Goodall was saying. You know, another individual who had witnessed a fast mover is a friend of mine, this guy named Bob McGuire. He even gave testimony to Ralph Blumenthal, the New York Times journalist, about this. When I published the trailer for my documentary, Jim Goodall is talking about an individual, another person who witnessed a USO on board a Navy submarine. And he didn't tell me the person's name, but that person reached out to me after seeing the trailer and was like, that was me he was talking about, which is this guy, Bob McGuire. This was Bob's very first time on a submarine. With Mark D'Antonio's case, this was his very first time on a submarine. They were invited as guests. They're not like Navy personnel per se, right? But there was some project that they were working on that there was need for them to come for some reason. And they can't tell me that because I guess it was like classified, right? But they, I guess, and many other people that have been on submarines are witnessing this. So they came to the conclusion that if this is so common, there has to be a program for cataloging them. I think with your question about, is this a processor mistake or a glitch in the system? When Bob McGuire poked around from his incident, everybody on board said, no, that's not a glitch. This happens from time to time.
And you talked about the admiral that had the email and the videos and they just went missing. Is there a thing on board submarines sometimes of guys you've ever heard complain about logging something and the next day they come to do their job and that log's gone?
I haven't looked into that. I think that would be more of a Tim Gallaudet thing. And I think he's actually looking into this more. I think he's actively trying to find more witnesses to this phenomenon.
Well, I've got a question for both of you, and this, I don't expect you to have the answer to it, but it's just to speculate on this idea that these fast movers must know that there's a submarine there that can detect them. It's almost like when they're going through the water, they don't care if they're detected. Do you have an idea of why they might be so, I don't know, blasé about it? Or are they deliberately showing themselves?
It's just that they don't find us, you know, a threat. So there's no real, it's not like the submarines could chase them or lock onto them and fire a torpedo at them. So we're probably just insignificant, just some monkeys in a boat under the water.
And Darcy, do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I think that's actually pretty accurate in my opinion as well. I mean, if you have these capabilities under the water, why would you be afraid of something that can only move 39 knots and shoot something at you that doesn't even go half your speed? So I don't know. I have no idea. I couldn't really say why, other than maybe the ocean is part of their domain. Maybe this is a place that they possibly reside and we're in their space. So we're just observing them more often there or not. I don't know.
I suppose the question could be asked about UFOs in the sky as well, because sometimes they just show themselves, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's more commonly discussed in the sky. We're not discussing it as much in the oceans. And I think that's why I wanted to make this documentary, to show that, you know, there's a history of them over our oceans and in our oceans. What if they're everywhere, you know?
And have you had any reports or heard anything about these USOs getting involved with submarines or ships that have nuclear weapons? Because we hear about them going over land-based nuclear missiles. Have they ever interfered with the nuclear submarine?
I don't know of an exact case, but most of our Los Angeles class submarines are nuclear, nuclear powered. So a bunch of them have thermal nuclear, cores, I guess, to power the whole ship. And then they also have warheads. And they're stacked to the teeth with nuclear ammunition. So maybe that's even why they're showing themselves. They don't like the fact that there's these nuclear bombs floating around inside of our oceans, where that could be their domain.
I mean, I'm sure they understand the dangers of nuclear energy. That is not just dangerous to us. It's not just dangerous to them, but it's also dangerous to the only planet we have to exist on in this solar system. So, you know, that's more than likely why they are so attracted, or not attracted, but they monitor it because of the implications if things go wrong.
Yeah, and I suppose the marine life could get badly affected as well, couldn't it? And that,
I mean, everything you're talking. Okay, just look at the I believe it was the Fukushima reactor during that earthquake and in the tsunami, where the radiation leaked to the ocean. That was all the way in Japan, and I believe it was a couple of months later or a year later they were testing the milk of cows from California and found excessively high, you know, levels of radiation because of that. So it literally traveled all across the ocean. It was being drank by our cows. We're milking the cows and distributing that milk all the way across the United States, where even milk in New York was being tested for higher than normal levels of radiation. So it's a real bad thing when, you know, nuclear technology goes wrong, or, you know, anything that we have that involves nuclear technology goes wrong. Like, just look at Chernobyl, you know, that's just because we got a handle of the situation, quote unquote, in a sense, but look at the disaster that created. So imagine something happens that's even worse than both of those. I mean, it's going to affect everybody on the planet, everything on the planet. It's going to affect the planet itself.
I remember with Chernobyl, when that happened, there were animals in the north of England on farms. The farmers were told, you can't sell this meat because we're detecting the radiation.
Yes, I mean, and radiation stays around for thousands of years. It does not go away like anytime soon. That's going to be here for a very, very, very long time. The radiation that leaks into the oceans is still there. It hasn't gone anywhere. It's just moving around.
Well, I mean, the one thing that insulates radiation, believe it or not, I mean, they usually dip whenever they have these vaults to store spent nuclear rods and stuff. They dip them in water and keep them deep in the ground, right? Because that it actually insulates the radiation, believe it or not. So the ocean does act as dilution and insulation for nuclear radiation if there is a spill, but
doesn't destroy it though. It's more like
but it doesn't. Yeah, it's just not good. And you know, you look at Japan; it's surrounded by aquatic life, and just to the point that I think Simon was making. That aquatic life is getting exposed to this radiation, and it's not like you're stopping the resale of this aquatic life at the markets in Japan and worldwide. People are still eating that, and I'm sure that that's not good for you if you're eating something that's highly irradiated. You know, if they're going to take beef off the market table, then they should be taking a lot of this fish and stuff.
Well, it's been great talking to you about this documentary, and you mentioned the other ones you've made before. Can you tell us how people can find them all, and do you have a website?
Yeah, my website is occultjourneys.com. You can check out the trailers for my docs and the posters, and click on the poster. It'll take you to a site to watch them. And yeah, I've made over 15 feature-length documentaries, some on the UFO phenomenon, some on cryptids, and even a cryptocurrency, a Bitcoin documentary. So covered a lot of different things. Thanks so much for having me on, Simon. If people want to check me out on social media, I am at Occult Journeys on Twitter and Instagram, Darcy Weir Films. And just Darcy Weir everywhere else. If you've got some cool UAP or UFO, USO stories you want to share, feel free to reach out to me on my website. I'd love to see if I can include that stuff in future documentaries.
Well, great. And Andy, again, thanks for you coming on as well.
I appreciate you. Thank you very much.
And I saw the documentary on Prime, and it was really enjoyable. And you know, I've been into UFOs for decades and read loads of books and talked to many people on this podcast, but there was still stuff in your documentary I hadn't heard before that was just fascinating. So I do recommend it.
Thank you, Simon. I really appreciate you supporting us, and you know, that's high praise from somebody who's been checking out this for decades. If they learn something new, that's important to me.
And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Hopefully we can come back and chat about future stories we're working on.
So the first half of this episode, I was talking to James Madden about his book, Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy, and the End of the World. And then in the second half, I was talking to Darcy Weir and Andy Marshall about the documentary Transmedium Fast Movers and USOs. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended version of this episode, which has an extra 45 minutes. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFO podcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try them out, you can use the 7-day free trial. And please check out my other podcast. It's called The Our Paranormal Afterlife. There are over 300 episodes. My website is pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.